second case, Umedi v. Plastec Holdings. Ms. O'Shana?
Good morning. My name is Carol O'Shana, and I represent Julie Umedi, sitting over there. Your Honor, we are here to ask you, excuse my voice, we are here to ask you to make right what went wrong below in the lower court and also in Ms. Umedi's employment. Ms. Umedi worked for Plastec for 8 years. Prior to that, she had 9 years of operator experience. She worked for a company that makes credit cards, plastic calendars, things of that nature. She began her employment with Plastec as a silkscreen operator. She then eventually moved to operating a lithographic press. She got regular raises, and her performances were deemed good. In fact, her worst performance review was deemed above average. In 2002, 7 years into her employment, she had a new supervisor named Ed Vega. Ed Vega began making comments to her in late September 2002, lasting through July 2003 when she quit.
Ms. O'Shana, when was the first time she complained about his comments in some way that would have alerted the employer to the fact that this was a sexual harassment complaint?
In February 2003 was the first time that she started complaining and told him about the statements that he made, such as, you know, he's talking about my breasts and the specific comments that he was making. She made that statement to Michael Bell, her human resources director. HR disputes that and says that she just complained about harassment and discrimination, so there is a question of fact, although he does acknowledge that she did say the company discriminates against women. So that happened in February when she first went there. Mind you, there was no sexual harassment policy. She went there on her own.
So I was going to ask whether there was some company policy, and the answer is no.
Well, not to her. There was a company policy, but not given to her. It was only given to the supervisors, according to one of the depositions. So she never received it. She didn't go to any seminars, but she asked somebody at work, and they told her to go to HR. So she did. She complained, and HR said they would take care of it. And nothing happened. And then shortly after she complained, in fact, right after she complained, her time cards started getting cut. She's working, you know, 38 hours, for example, and Ed Vega is only approving her 35.5 with no explanation.
Now, one of the things your opponents argue, and certainly the way the district court saw this case, is as a case where the adverse employment action was what you're labeling a constructive termination and what the district court judge thought was simply her decision to leave. But you've argued in your briefs that there are lots more things. And I just want to make sure that you, in fact, presented that theory to the district court.
I did. I attached all the time cards to as an exhibit, and I referenced them in my brief. An adverse employment action, it says, under Markle versus Board of Regents, typically, adverse employment actions are economic injuries. I think that's axiomatic. And she suffered diminution in pay. She wasn't paid for the time that she worked. The time card says 38 hours, for example. She's docked 2.5 hours for no explanation. She works through lunch. She's not paid for it. Her breaks are taken away. Her hours are shortened. She suffered clear economic injuries. There's no question about that.
Is this part of the retaliation claim?
This is part of the sex discrimination and retaliation claim, but the adverse employment action is under both.
Was that adverse action in retaliation? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it was in retaliation for her complaining. It happened in the same month that she complained, and then all the subsequent months thereafter. She was also given a poor performance review in March of 2003, when her colleague, with whom she worked on the same exact machine producing the same exact product, his productivity was increased, improved since last year. Hers is up and down. They're producing the exact same product, working on the exact same machine.
Now, they do say he has a somewhat different role. So is it your point that at least you can't talk about productivity because that's the same, or is it something different?
Exactly. It falls under productivity. The analysis of the review is under productivity. How can you produce two different types of or amounts of things when you're producing the exact same product?
So it's not saying she wanders away from the machine for periods of time, or I thought that was one of the accusations.
That may have been one, which she disputes, of course, because there's no write-ups whatsoever for her, no written reprimands, nothing in her entire employment history. In fact, the only sort of written reprimand that they gave her was after she quit, and then they wrote up something about how her, she was writing on her time cards. But no mention, of course, that she's walking away from her machine, she's taking too many breaks, nothing. No evidence whatsoever. And furthermore, Your Honors, you know, my client was treated differently than all the other employees in the plant. And I attached some time cards showing that, you know, these are all similarly situated employees because, I mean, it's really quite simple. They're punching in, punching out, punching in, punching out. You get paid for the time that you punch in and punch out. It's obvious. And they're all getting paid for the time that they're punching in and punching out. In fact, they're getting paid more than their time of punching in, punching out. I can see that some of the exhibits, the employees are not taking lunches and getting paid for it, not taking breaks and getting paid for it. She's not taking lunches either, not getting paid for it. Her time cards are reflecting a total number of hours worked, and she's, with no explanation on the time card whatsoever, she's getting paid less. I mean, for example, Exhibit 14, 37.25 hours. She works. Ed Vega only approves 34.75 hours. Where's the explanation? If she's supposedly, you know, working too many hours or taking too many breaks, 2.5 hours a week, that's theft. And as far as I'm concerned, and the HR person said, theft is grounds for termination. And that was never terminated, not even written up. But other employees were written up for taking too many breaks. So there's a question of fact of whether the jury's going to believe their statements. Furthermore, Your Honors, the lower court noted, you know, that defendant waived the argument of the prima facie case and the retaliation count, and they even said it in their opinion, and the Judge Norgel said it in his opinion, that defendant didn't raise that. The only questions that they raised was the question of whether or not she performed well and whether or not she was similarly situated, and we obviously proved that she did perform her job satisfactorily and that other similarly situated employees that punched in, punched out, and worked on the press were paid.
Now, another point that was made in the district court opinion was whether this writing on the time cards happened before or after the supervisor had reviewed the time cards, right? As I understood the company's position, they said, well, she was writing on the time cards after her supervisor reviewed and the others were not.
Yeah, and they present no proof of that, no write-ups about that. That's theft. That's going in and saying, oh, I worked, 8 hours, never mind. It was actually 9. That's company theft. That's stealing money. And they don't fire her for it? No write-ups? No warnings? No nothing? Yeah, I mean, if she's going back in and writing on her time cards after they're approved, how could that possibly be when HR is admitting that they don't even know whose handwriting is on the time cards? They have no idea.
Was this Mr. Bell or somebody
Mr.
else?
Mr. Bell,
He said he didn't know whose handwriting it was.
Right. So, I mean, they're completely fabricating this. And the timing is suspicious when they bring it all after she files a lawsuit and not before. Furthermore, other people are writing on their time cards. I submitted time cards. People are writing all over them. And they're not written up for it either. She's, again, I think one of the bigger issues in this case, and I wanted to reserve 10 minutes, so if you could just warn me. One of the bigger issues in this case also is hostile work environment. You know, that was one of the claims. Now, a lower court analyzed hostile work environment under sex discrimination, which I didn't think that was right. So I think that, and looking at the past cases, they're analyzed separately. So looking at the hostile work environment cases, they look at the totality of the circumstances. Now, the comments that she was subjected to and endured consisted of statements such as, women don't belong here, women don't belong in the press room. And he said that very often. He said, women should be working in a flower shop. He asked her what business she had getting pregnant at her age when she suffered a miscarriage. Asked her if she had breast implants over the weekend. Women think they know everything. She should wear lower cut blouses and shorter shorts. When she's bending over, oh, that's perfect. Stay like that. He told her to clean the press room because that's what women are supposed to do. He said just because she's a woman didn't mean she didn't have to take out the trash. And her partner, Wayne, heard him say the statement that he didn't want to hear any excuses from her just because she's a woman. This is a woman that's been working there 8 years, and all of a sudden she's getting all these statements from this guy, her supervisor, basically saying that she's inferior because she's a woman and that she can't work there.
Saying all of a sudden, did these all come in a short period of time?
It started in the end of approximately fall 2002 and continued on through July 2003.
Well, by all of a sudden, you mean, I thought you meant it's when Mr. Vega comes in as the supervisor, that prior supervisors had not been
right
saying such things.
Exactly. So he comes in, but he didn't start making the comments until around the end of fall 2002.
When exactly does he come in?
Sometime in 2002. I think it's in the middle of 2002, maybe the beginning. But okay. It didn't start right away. It definitely came sometime later. Okay. So he's making these comments to her, and the lower court looked at some of the most benign cases in analyzing whether or not she suffered a hostile work environment. You know, cases where, you know, the employer would say things like, oh, nice skirt. Oh, you look nice today. Oh, it's getting hot in here since you walked in. You know, none of those statements have the weight of saying women don't belong here. It's like saying blacks don't belong here. They belong in McDonald's. I mean, women don't belong here. They belong in a flower shop. Those kind of statements have heavy impact on a work environment, especially when they're compounded with all of the harassing things that he did, such as cutting her time cards, giving her a poor performance review, telling her that, you know, she basically making her workplace a living hell, taking away her breaks. She's the only one. You know, and this is really important, Your Honors. We got thousands of time cards, I think, thousands, definitely 1,000 at least. And not one employee, and defendant never produced a single time card showing that, hey, look at all these other employees. They got docked too. Just like she did. And I mean, it's obvious that if that were the case and if other similarly situated employees had received that similar treatment, they'd be attached. I could bring a box to show the court that there's none. You know, so for those reasons, Your Honor, I don't know how much time I have left, but for those reasons, I'm just going to reserve the rest of the time for the rebuttal. So we ask that you reverse the lower court and let us proceed to trial.
Thank you, Ms. Osana. Mr. Lee?
Good morning, Your Honors. John Lee of Freeborn and Peter on behalf of Appellee and Defendant Plastec Holdings, LLC. Peeled back to its core, Appellant's case is premised upon two broad categories of alleged misconduct. The first category are comments that were allegedly made by Mr. Vega to Appellant starting late 02 through July 03 when she resigned her position at Plastec. The second category that the Appellant now focuses on appeal deals with the issue of time cards. The allegation is that Mr. Vega altered her time cards, and not only did he alter them, and this is important, but he altered them because of discriminatory animus.
Because she had complained.
Because she had complained or because
behavior.
She was a woman.
Right, both.
Okay. Now, with regard to the first category of conduct, Your Honor, for the purposes of summary judgment and for the purposes of appeal, we did not contest those allegations and we take those to be true. Now, when we take those to be true, it is apparent to me that those comments, if true, are boorish, piggish, insensitive, and offensive. Sometimes very offensive. However, under the law of this circuit, under cases like Peel, those comments taken in their totality do not rise to the level sufficient to constitute a hostile work environment that is required where plaintiff appellant is claiming constructive discharge.
Well, let's take two parts of that, Mr. Lee, because as you, of course, recognize, the test is severe or pervasive. And some of her testimony, which you rightly say, you know, at this stage of the game, you know, we accept, is that many of these comments were quite pervasive, that it was done on a constant basis. Some of the comments, I mean, are actually pretty shocking. The thought that you would say to somebody after she had a miscarriage, you know, why did she become pregnant is terrible. and comments about physical attributes and the like are also. But our issue here is whether she has alleged enough to get to trial. You know, and I'm sure, you know, clearly the company would have its own case to make if there were a trial. But this looks pretty pervasive to me, and so, with elements of severity blended in, if you will.
Well, Your Honor, the quote from Hill Dyson is that the harassment must be so severe and pervasive as to alter the conditions of the victim's employment and create an abusive working environment.
Right, that's right.
And just addressing that point, Your Honor, and perhaps it might be useful to talk in broad terms about some of the cases that were raised in our briefs. For example, in the Perry case, which is a Seventh Circuit case, where there the facts were that the plaintiff suffered daily abuse for 14 months. She was asked if she was a quote-unquote screamer during sex. There were comments about her breasts, the hardness of her nipples. There were sexual overtures to her. There were comments made that she should wear a low blouse because of her breast size. Another case, Tatum, where a supervisor grabbed the plaintiff's hands and put it over his penis and made other sexual overtures to her over a period of time. In Baskerville, another Seventh Circuit case, over 7 months, the plaintiff was called a pretty girl. The supervisor made grunting noises when she walked by in a leather skirt, said that all pretty girls should run around naked, likened her situation to that of Anita Hill, made masturbation gestures in her presence all over the course of 7 months. So, Your Honor, I personally am in agreement that the statements, if made, are offensive.
Well, and I suppose what this case has that maybe you don't find in all of these other cases is the combination. Behavior doesn't have to be sexual per se. The combination of statements all to the effect of women don't belong here, that's a very work-oriented, you know, undermining your position in the workplace sort of thing, which if believed, you know, if a trier of fact were to believe it, makes it look more like, you know, a Smith against Sheehan kind of situation where the harasser, who is in a supervisory position, I might add, and so, you know, we certainly have, under this complaint structure, we don't have any issue about derivative liability. The harasser is pretty constantly telling her, because you're a woman, I don't want you here, and I'm going to demean you sexually on top of that.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the facts in this case are very analogous to Weiss and Baskerville. While there are statements that women don't belong in the press room and whatnot, there are also statements made in the record that complaints on the part of plaintiffs that she shouldn't have to do certain types of work because she's a woman. So you have kind of the gender issues, I agree, kind of to some extent coloring the overall discussion. But with regard to the hostile environment, Your Honor, which really looks at whether or not there are overtures with regard to of a sexual nature, and that's...
But that's not only that. We've tried to be clear about this, and in fact we've said the whole reason a hostile work environment comes up under Title VII is, as you pointed out from the Hill Dyson, it's because ultimately it's a form of discrimination on the basis of whatever. I mean, there could be a hostile racial environment, there could be a hostile environment based on sex, there could be a hostile environment based on somebody's religion, whatever the protected characteristic may be. And eventually, it's because the terms and conditions of your employment are not equal to those of the people who were not in the protected category. And if only women, or in her case, because she was the only one, only she, because she was a woman, is getting this, why isn't that a case that goes to a jury on different terms and conditions of employment?
And I suppose, Your Honor, that it's not, there is no bright line rule for this particular test. It is a continuum. A continuum that the court has to look at in comparison to the overall environment. One of the things I would add that does color the facts in this case as well is a testimony by appellant that she didn't really feel harassed until March or April of 07 when those conversations with Mr. Bellstar take place. And so while she talks about these behaviors taking place from late 02 all the way through her departure, I think it is telling, Your Honor, that number one, she herself admits, and this undisputed, that she didn't feel subjectively, and as you know, hostile environment has to be both objective and subjective. Subjectively harassed until March or April of 2003. And also,
but you would agree, I mean, if we wanted to start with March or April, she doesn't quit till August, right?
It's July, Your Honor.
Or it's July, whatever. So there are a few months.
And yes, Your Honor, I do agree with that with regard to timing. My only point is that based upon the record, there are countervailing factors here that weren't present, for example, in the Peel case or in other cases that counsel for dismissing the claims as a matter of law for failure to create a hostile work environment.
Mr. Lee, do you think the district court focused at all or sufficiently on the anti-female animus as opposed to the sexual desire or sexual advance?
Your Honor, from the opinion, I guess I can't tell. Your Honor, I believe that as a matter of law, the district court is presumed to have considered all the materials that are placed before him, and certainly with regard to, I know, the allegations with regard to wage and the time cards, the district court did consider that because he said so on page 4 of his opinion. But with regard to whether or not district court adequately considered the women in the workplace issues as opposed to the more sexually oriented issues, that, Your Honor, I can tell from the opinion. With regard to the second category, that is the time cards, which appellant tries to overlay on all of this to try to defeat summary judgment, Your Honor, with regard to the time cards, I guess I would make 3 points. One is that the district court did address the time card issue. Number two is that the allegations that Mr. Vega altered the time cards as a result of discriminatory animus is completely unsupported in the record. And
but why, you know, the evaluations are kind of interesting to me in that respect, because even until she starts complaining, the evaluations that she gets are actually quite positive. January 2002, Mr. Vega herself describes her as somebody who corrects mistakes well, recognizes what's good quality, meets expectations in the amount of work, works well with others on all shifts, needs no close supervision. That doesn't sound like somebody who's wandering off from the machine. Will work overtime when needed. He takes a 180 turn in this March 2003 review. It's one can draw an inference from that that something has happened, and one thing that happened is that she complained.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I think you're right. One could draw an inference that something happened. I don't think that the record supports inference that those actions were as a result of the actions that appellant's complaining about are as a result of her reporting those alleged activities
to management. How do you think the record excludes that inference when the timing actually is pretty good? You know, she starts complaining in February, and a month later, not earlier, he writes this rather negative, I mean, compared to her earlier reviews, it's not as negative as it could be, but a much more negative review.
I believe in a number of ways, Your Honor. Number one, Mr. Bell, in his deposition, that's part of the records applied by appellants, talks about the fact that he had discussions with Mr. Vega even before then with regard to some of these issues. I think that with regard to appellant also argues that his alteration of the time cards happened to take place as a result of his meetings with her meetings with Mr. Bell.
But and the evidence on the handwriting on the time card seems to be fairly weak if Mr. Bell testified that he couldn't tell whose handwriting it was. How do we know she's the one? Or how do we know on any other time card where there was handwriting was done either before or after the supervisory review?
And again, Your Honor, this is where this is why in the beginning I talked about the fact that with regard to the time cards, the issue is not only that the time cards were altered, but they were altered as a result of discriminatory animus. Now, it's undisputed that the supervisors at the company had the authority and were required to review time cards to make sure that they accurately reflected work that was performed by the employees. And it was happened, quote unquote, all the time that the supervisors would deduct time off of time cards
but,
to meet those obligations.
But in her case, apparently, this hadn't been happening before. I'm just wondering, you know, even if the inferences that you're arguing are permissible inferences from this evidence, are they necessary inferences from this evidence, or do we have a situation where there are two possible views somebody could take of it.
And again, Your Honor, with regard to the time cards, I believe there cannot be an inference drawn to support plaintiff's claim of retaliation. For example, she complains on her time cards and says that he started docking her pay on work that she worked at the end of January and that that time card was submitted on February 1st. The record is undisputed that Mr. Bell didn't inform Mr. Vega of the meetings until after the second meeting at the earliest that he had with Ms. Bumetti. Ms. Bumetti admits that it wasn't until sometime in February, perhaps early February, that she met with Mr. Bell. There's no evidence in the record that Mr. Vega knew of that first meeting, whenever it was in February. And so therefore, there's nothing from the record that could draw a causal link between something that was done on February 1 and a meeting that was had, or Mr. Vega's knowledge of that meeting subsequent to that particular activity.
If this were only a retaliation case, maybe you would be right. But I guess she is using the time card evidence. So kind of the events overlap in time, and the evidence also overlaps in time. She's also using this in part as evidence of the animus based on sex.
And I understand that. And that's what, with regard to the time card, Your Honor, it's important to actually look into the time, to kind of analyze the time cards a bit. She offered 12 time cards of plaintiff's time cards to the courts. And if you look at those time cards, of those 12, in five of them, Mr. Vega actually increases her time, doesn't decrease her time. On two of them, Mr. Vega adopts the time that's on the card. And on five of them, he deducts a half an hour here, a quarter of an hour here, an hour there. Okay? Now, so the record, there is an inference, well, the record is clear that he did deduct some time from her card. The question is, can she say that he did so as a result, could draw an inference as a result of sex discrimination, as opposed to the company's undisputed policy of what supervisors do? And to support that, she makes a couple of arguments. Number one, she offers time cards of other purportedly similarly situated employees and says, look, they're giving credit for their breaks. But if you look at those exhibits, Your Honor, that's not exactly true. If you look at the exhibits, a number of the exhibits that she submitted from other employees were not in the same department. A number of the time cards were after she left. And the four time cards that dealt with people in her department who are similarly situated, during the time that she was there, the time approved is actually the time that's stated on the time card. And so in order to draw that second link, which she needs to, which is that the time card, the alteration time cards are not a result of the undisputed policy of the company, but because of explicitly directed either sexual animus or retaliation, that is the link that she cannot make in light of the record before this court. And so therefore, I don't believe that an inference is reasonable that with regard to the time cards that gives rise to support a claim either for discrimination or because of the timing of retaliation. It's just simply not, an inference could be made, it's not a reasonable one. And as the court realized, you know, metaphysical doubt always exists, but metaphysical questions aren't sufficient to survive summary judgment. Now, with regard to also interesting, Your Honor, the appellant also makes the argument that other people worked on their time cards, and yet they weren't docked pay. But in fact, if the court looks at some of the exhibits 43 to 46 that appellant herself provided, people that took excessive breaks, people that were tardy, people that took excessive lunches, they were not only docked their pay, some of them were suspended. So there were men and women who experienced much more harsh repercussions for their untimeliness than plaintiffs had. Furthermore, it's undisputed in the testimony of Mr. Bell that there was another gentleman who also was alerted to the fact that he was altering the time cards after the supervisor had been altering them. And that's the issue. It's not whether they altered them before. It's once the supervisor approves them, then do they go back and re-alter them.
Yeah. What's your evidence that she does that?
In the deposition of Mr. Bell, Your Honor, Mr. Bell says that when in her conversation with her, she admitted that she did that.
But she denies that, right? So why isn't that an issue of fact?
Actually, Your Honor, she doesn't deny that she did it, the timing of it. She doesn't deny that she did it after the supervisor approve the time cards. Her contention is that we can't show that any other male colleagues that did that were not similarly reprimanded. And in fact, as Mr. Bell testified, other male colleagues, there was a male gentleman who was reprimanded for doing the exact same thing. I want to touch briefly, Your Honor, with regard to the Title VII 90-day notice requirement. Appellant has raised the issue that we failed to file a cross-appeal with regard to that issue, and that's what's not probably before this court. As the court has stated before, the appellee can raise any grounds on which to affirm the underlying or the decision at issue, and therefore we believe the issue is probably before this court. And given the undisputed facts, we believe that plaintiff failed to meet the 90-day jurisdictional requirement under Title VII.
But the district court finds, as a fact, surely our review here is abuse of discretion. The district court finds that she, in fact, for whatever reason, did not receive that first thing. Actually, you probably saw a couple of days ago, not that this is evidence in the record, but the Chicago Tribune headline the other day was that Chicago has the worst public mail system, apparently, in the United States.
I did see that, Your Honor.
Unfortunately. And maybe that's what the district judge was thinking of, maybe something else. But he accepts the finding that she didn't get it. And it would be very hard to show prejudice in this instance. It's a difference of about a week if she had received the first thing. I think I figured out would have been due around the 21st of January, and it comes in around the 28th, so there's 7 days. There's no prejudice, and the district judge accepts her account. So what is there for us really to review?
In fact, Your Honor, if the five-day mail rule operates as a matter of law, the difference is actually only 1 day.
All right. So, but Your Honor, less, yeah.
But the 90-day requirement is jurisdictional. And courts have held, including this court, that even a one-day delay is material with regard to Title VII claims. With regard to the district court's findings, Your Honor, just argument is that as a matter of law, a plaintiff cannot stand upon her own suppositions that she just never received it in order to defeat
summary
judgment.
Why not? I mean, she testifies, I didn't receive it. We don't have the old common law rule that people are disabled from testifying in their own behalf. She tells the judge that she didn't ever receive it and that she was really looking out for it and checking her mail every day, and so was her husband and all the rest of it, and the district judge accepts that. I really don't see. I agree with you that there's no reason why you can't present this, because I think this would be an alternative ground on which to support the judgment. But once we get to it, I think that you run up against the wall of abuse of discretion review or clear error or whatever you want to call it.
I see my time is up, unless there are any further questions.
If you wish to respond, you.
Yes. Your Honor, the cases in Jones and Sever, it really goes down to the standard under 56 about what the summary judgment standard is. And, of course, one iteration of that is whether or not there are facts upon which a reasonable jury can return a verdict on behalf of the non-moving party. And what the courts found in Jones and Sever is that faced with the facts such as the ones given here, you know, the admission that, and she does admit that the EEOC issued the notice on October 24th. She admits that that the postal office tried to deliver the letter. She admits that it was unclaimed and went back to the EEOC. The only thing she denies is that she ever got notice of it. In light of that factual scenario, Your Honor, under Jones and Savra, I believe it's a matter of law that no reasonable jury would find for the plaintiff. And so I do believe, Your Honor, that the court can review that issue and rule on that as a matter of law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. O'Shaughnessy?
Thank you. Your Honors, my opposing counsel states that the time cards show that Ed Vega actually gave her more hours than what was reflected in the time cards. That's totally inaccurate. The time cards show that she got paid less. You know, sometimes he had to add time if she, for example, forgot to punch out. And then, of course, the time cards reflect that she didn't work that day. So, yeah, she writes in, I worked in 7.5 hours, or she forgot to punch in, and therefore it doesn't reflect it. So the time cards are added to as a day that's missing. So that extra day is added on. But when you look at the time cards, You can see even Exhibit 19, she forgot to punch in on one of the days. But nonetheless, Ed Vega cuts her time every hour. I mean, he's cutting her half an hour, 45 minutes, every single day with no explanation.
How many of these time cards do we have in the record up here? I mean, it sounds to me like we just have to look at the time cards.
6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I think 11 or 12 time cards for her, showing that, you know, she's not getting paid properly. Now, he says that there's a timing issue. She says she complained early February. The very first time she gets docked for, or not paid for the time she worked was the week ending February 1, and it was for a quarter of an hour. So she complains early February. He says, oh, I don't have a meeting with Ed Vega until later. Well, he tells Julie, I'm going to take care of it. I'm going to take care of it. And quite frankly, the pattern, the real pattern, started March 1st, the end of March 1st. That's when he started just over and over again. Every single day, he's just going on and on and on and on and on. So maybe the jury would find that the February 1 was either he knew about it, or maybe that was just some, you know, unusual factor. It was only a quarter of an hour. She didn't even notice when she got her paycheck. But, of course, she did notice 2.5 hours, which amounts to about $50 a week, you know, 3 hours of missing time. So, and then plus she's working, again, through lunch, not getting paid that half hour. That's $9 that she's stripped of. Plus he takes away her breaks. She doesn't get breaks. She's allowed 2 10-minute breaks a day. He says, no breaks for you. Nobody else gets that treatment. Nobody. Just her. And he said, they say, oh, well, she got paid 15 minutes for that. Well, where's the 5 minutes that she didn't get paid? And granted, in a day, that may be nothing, but in 6 days, that's 30 minutes. That's money. So, and maybe $10 or $50 is not a lot of money to some people, but for others, it's groceries. It's a car payment. Now, he says that she admits, Julie admitted that she increased her time after they're approved. That's not true. That's a totally what she said. Again, she says if she wrote on her time cards at all, it was before they were approved. How could
this is in her deposition? I mean, where would we look to see where this exchange is taking place?
Okay, let me see.
I mean, you don't need to waste
your
time.
Yeah, I mean,
it's in her deposition.
Yes,
we will find it.
It's definitely in her deposition where, you know, she writes on her time cards before they're approved, not after. And even in Michael Bell's deposition, I ask him about it. There's an exchange about that. And he says, you know, the time cards are taken to a place after they're approved and left there. So my question to him was, what did she do, break into an office and go and grab them and write on them after the fact? And there's a question of fact raised here because, Your Honor, I mean, it's common sense. If you're altering time cards after they're approved by a supervisor and saying, oh, no, I worked more hours, not fewer, more, that's theft. You're taking company money, and you should be fired for that. And they admit that you would get fired for theft. And she's not even written up, not even reprimanded,
so
nothing.
So the record shows that time cards are not available to the employee after the supervisor has...
That's what Michael Bell said. You know, they're in another room and whatnot. And, of course, he says, I don't even know whose handwriting that is. Mm-hmm. So, and what if she's writing on her own time cards, this is very interesting, Your Honor. She's writing on her own time cards after the fact that she's got greater hours. Well, I mean, sometimes she's not writing on them at all. There's no handwriting on them whatsoever, except Ed Vega's handwriting where he approves fewer hours. How do you explain that? Of course, they offer no explanation. They say, oh, well, you know, they do it to other employees, too. Okay, show me one time card. One out of the 200 employees that they have. Thousands of time cards. Show me one. They don't even show one. So,
all right, the other thing your opponent has said is, you know, however unpleasant Mr. Vega's behavior was. You can look at all of these other cases from this circuit that also tell some pretty discouraging stories from the point of view of good behavior. And this doesn't seem to be notably worse than those, so why not summary judgment? Well, that seems to be one of the things the district court thought. The district court thought, yeah, maybe it wasn't great, but it's not bad enough to be actionable.
Well, the court cited Patton versus Keystone, where they actually did find that there was a question of fact of hostile work environment. And in that case, there were only a few comments, approximately three in a one-month period. And there was some touching and stalking, too, and that was important to the court. But in terms of the statements, that case wasn't at all like this one because Julie suffered far more comments. She had at least six times as many for a greater period of time. The other case that they cited, Rhodes versus Illinois Department of Transportation, that one, she complained about things that were trivial, such as she had no heat in her truck for a few days, they changed her route, and she only suffered this for one winter season. And then there was only two statements that he made, whereas Julie had 10 months of at least a minimum of 18 statements, and she says that he made the statements very often. And she had significant changes in her pay, whereas Rhodes, she just didn't get heat. And she just, got a change of a route, and she didn't like it. But Julie, on the other hand, is getting $50 less a week or more. So the cases that he cites are totally different. I mean, I like the girls to run around naked in the office. Well, that's very, very different from being told, you're just not good enough because you're a woman, essentially. You can't do the job because you're a woman. And those statements are far heavier than mere, you have nice legs. I mean, not to say that that's acceptable for a supervisor. It's still, I would construe that as boorish and piggish. But when you reach the point where you're starting to question someone's ability because of their immutable characteristics, I'm sorry, that point, that's not boorish and piggish behavior. That is unacceptable in the workplace, especially by a supervisor.
Ms. O'Shaughnessy, your time has expired.
Oh, is that stopped? I'm sorry.
That's what the red light is. Yeah. Oh. You want to make a concluding remark, you can.
We just ask your honors to find in favor of our client and let the jury decide on these issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.